Well, thank you, Al, for that presentation. My heart's in China, too, as I think you know. And let me give you a name at the University of Sydney, Ted Fekerall. He's a professor emeritus in mathematical physics, very strong Christian, and I think it'd be great for your friend to meet him. So, Fekerall, F-E-C-K-E-R-E-L-L, Ted. He's one of our Reasons to Believe volunteers at the University of Sydney. And he's probably the most famous professor on the campus. So, and also I'd like to encourage you to pray for, remember I told you a few weeks ago about the 12 professors from China that came and visited our Reasons to Believe office. They're now in other parts of the country. They'll be coming back through our way, so we'll have a second meeting with them. But these are 12 professors that are funded by the Chinese government to come to the United States to learn about religion and faith, or religion and science, so they can go back to their country and teach classes at the graduate level on science and religion. And they're all atheists and agnostics, and they came, their first stop was Reasons to Believe, and their last stop is going to be Reasons to Believe. So appreciate your prayers for them, and you know, amazing things are happening in China. In fact, we enjoyed a real good joke with the 12 that the difference between China and the United States is that here in the United States, we're free to criticize our government, but we're not free to criticize Charles Darwin. Whereas in China, you're free to criticize Charles Darwin, but you're not free to criticize the government. And the irony of it is, this is a Christian nation, and they're an atheist nation. You'd think it'd be the other way around. But I was encouraged that all 12 of them really appreciated the humor and the irony about that situation. And they all knew about the stories of the Chinese scientists making their discoveries of a Cameron explosion in China, and how this is really disturbing the whole Darwinian paradigm. Let me tighten this up a little bit. And I do apologize. I promised I was going to get you those sheets for our little homework assignments in the Book of Job. But yesterday we were on the northern tip of Vancouver Island, and it took us until late last evening to get back. So I've not had time to prepare. We had to clean up the messes our boys left in our home. So wasn't quite as bad as I anticipated it would be, so I'm kind of proud that they kept things in order, given the fact they had so many guests over. So, but I really wanted to thank the class again. I mean, you guys gave us that special gift of my birthday, and that gave us enough funds to do something Kathy's been wanting me to do for 4 years. And that's go up to the north tip of Vancouver Island and see the orca whales in their natural habitat. And we got to do that. And she says, Hugh, I want to go at the driest time of the year. And I said, that would be late August. So we went there, but I can tell you all the sunscreen I took was totally superfluous. It didn't rain the whole time. It only rained 90% of the time. The other 10%, it was heavily overcast. So, well, it was funny talking to the locals because they said, you know, we've had a drought this year. We've only had 3 meters of rain so far this year. I said, 3 meters since January? And I said, no, that's a drought for them. And they were very excited that they were finally getting some decent rain, but the decent rain was right in the middle of our vacation slot. But fortunately, we were well prepared. We had some good gear. And in spite of all the rain, in spite of Kathy being a Southern California girl, she really did enjoy. I mean, we got to see these orca whales playing like 100 feet in front of us. We were on the beach, and they were right there. They were doing the usual flips in the air and whapping their tail and having a good time. And so Kathy wants to thank you, too. I thank you for making all that possible. It's a great time. But a lot of rain. And I kept telling Kathy, that's why it's so green here. So, but again, thanks. Yeah, this is the, I'll let you take a look at this, by the way. This is what the book that will be available next week, Who is Adam? Written by myself and Fazal Rana. We all know him as Fuzz, but Fuzzle is his real name. And this is Fuzz's second book that he's written with me. The first one was The Origins of Life. This is one on The Origin of Humanity. By the way, if you look at the insides of the book, you'll think it was written by Al Trussell. It's all about economics. We took an economics book and put the cover on it. But if you want to see what it looks like, I'll pass it. I do want this back by the end of the class that you can take a look at, and we should have that available next week. And we already have available our new DVD, Cosmic Fingerprints. I think it's out there on the table. But what I want to share with you is a discovery that is really gratifying for the research that we've been doing at Reasons to Believe for the past 10 years. And 10 years ago, we got a bunch of biologists together at our offices at Reasons to Believe, and they met with two of our physicists, myself and Dave Rogstad, and also for a while one of our board members. Oh boy, I've been on vacation too long. Alex Metherall, our medical doctor slash physicist. And over the course of 3 years, we developed what we believe is a mathematical model for biological speciation and extinction. And there's a brand new discovery published in Science that gives some really strong support for what we developed back 10 years ago. Now, let me just give you a quick survey of what our speciation model is like. It's described very briefly in our book, The Genesis Question, which I think is also at the table. But when we got together, and we said we have biologists, and we had a couple of people from Caltech that were part of a new department of mathematical biology, and they and Lynn Carter, who I think a lot of you know, they were part of the class here, really launched the project of trying to build this speciation model. And you know, the whole point is we see in the fossil record both extinction and speciation. But there are factors that will determine whether or not a species, through natural process, will be able to evolve into a distinctly different species. And we looked at a number of factors that first work for the extinction of a species before it would have an opportunity to speciate. And the thing we noted, and this is where the physicists and the astronomers made the contribution, we said what we notice in biology is that when mutations take place, and by the way, that's the only way you can get significant change through natural process in a species. Natural selection basically works to stabilize a species, not to change it. But mutations is where you get the changes taking place. However, the problem is that the number of mutations that are harmful for the species and work for their extinction far outnumber those that are beneficial. In fact, the best you see for any species is a ratio of 10,000 harmful mutations for every beneficial mutation, and the worst you see is 10 million harmful for every one that's beneficial. And so what that means is that every species is on a race, and it's on a race in the following perspective. Planet Earth does not provide us with a stable environment. Neither does the solar system provide us with a stable environment. The sun is changing significantly in its brightness with respect to time. And the history of life on planet Earth is it first had to deal with the sun getting 15% dimmer, then the sun getting 15% brighter. We have plate tectonics working at a much less efficient level today. I mean, radiometric decay at the time of life's origin was 5 times as intense as it is today, and the rotation rate is at least 4 times slower today than it was back then. And right away, that kind of helps you understand why the Earth had bacterial life 3.8 billion years ago and nothing more advanced than bacterial life for billions of years later. 3.8 billion years ago, you got intense radiation from the sun, you got intense radiation from radiometric decay, and you got a rotation rate that is so rapid that the wind velocity 2 feet off the ground is about 2,000 miles an hour. And so that's why you don't want to have big stuff running around the face of the Earth. And it's not going to be able to handle a shear. Because the problem with this is right at the surface of the Earth, no matter how fast the Earth is rotating, the wind velocity will be zero. But the faster the Earth rotates, the more rapidly the wind velocity picks up as you move from the surface. So, for example, if God had created us 3.8 billion years ago, you'd have a wind velocity of 0 miles per hour on the soles of your feet. At your ankles, it would be about 500 miles an hour. And at the top of your head, it would be about 2,500 miles an hour. Now, you can imagine what that would do to a six-foot-tall person. It would shear his body into little bits and pieces. So that kind of explains why you only have small stuff at the beginning. But the whole point is that given the number of negative mutations relative to positive mutations, each species is on a race to pick up enough of those beneficial mutations that it can change into a distinctly different species, better able to adapt to the changing physics of the solar system before it's driven to extinction by the negative mutations. And so what we did 10 years ago is to figure out what those factors are. And we identified about 15 factors, and probably the most interesting one in terms of this new discovery is body size. That the bigger the body size, the higher the probability that the species will go extinct before it can speciate. Now I'll just give you the bottom line. After 3 years of research, we determined that in terms of purely natural process, bacteria have a good probability of being able to evolve quickly enough that they can adapt to the changing environment. But that anything bigger than, say, 1 centimeter body size will be driven to extinction before it can speciate. And any species that's got a population less than 1 quadrillion individuals likewise will go extinct before it can speciate. And any species that has a maturation time, a time from being born to being able to reproduce, that's greater than 3 months will also go extinct before it can produce a new species through these mutations. And so what that does is show you that, a large percentage of life on planet Earth simply does not have the means to naturally evolve into a distinctly different species before it's driven to extinction by changes in the environment and by the accumulation of negative mutations. Okay, what we lacked 10 years ago was good field research to confirm what we had developed through mathematics and physics. And but what's happened in the intervening 10 years is that, especially with birds, there has been field research forthcoming that is confirming everything that we had deduced 10 years ago. And that's not surprising, because birds are the easiest species to observe in the field. They fly, after all, and they're big. And also, there aren't a huge number of species, and they're easy to pick out of the environment and see how they relate with other species. And so it's not surprising that's been the first field research. Okay, what's brand new is that we now have some research on mammals. This was published a couple of weeks ago in Science Magazine, looking at the mammals. So it's the first detailed study on mammals that's been done in the context of speciation and extinction. And what these scientists did is essentially what we do at Reasons to Believe. They didn't exactly do the field research. They decided to do a vast literature survey and survey all the literature in terms of field research of mammals. And that was actually a good way to go, because it simply wouldn't be possible for one research team to do the necessary field research by themselves. So they just surveyed the last 30 years' worth of literature. And they wound up with field research studies on 4,000 land mammal species. Now, what's significant about that is that's a little more than 85% of all the land mammal species that exist. And so this is actually much more extensive than anything that's been done on a bird. You know, in terms of bird research, we're probably looking at about 25 species that have been studied in the field in terms of their extinction factors. But now we have a study on 4,000 land mammal species, literally more than 85% of the total number that exists on the planet. And they decided to look specifically at body size. And I think quite correctly, they picked out body size as probably being the most significant factor for species extinction. And they were able to cover the complete range of body sizes. It covered from 2 grams all the way up to 4,000 kilograms. 2 grams would be a particular bat that ranks as the smallest land mammal species in existence. It's actually even smaller than a shrew. And it goes all the way up to an elephant. That's where they got the 4,000 kilograms. But as you can see, it covers many orders of magnitude range in the body mass size. And then what they did is they looked, let me see if I can find my notes here. Here we go. They looked at body mass in the context of 6 other extinction factors. Now, if you look at our book of the Genesis Question, you'll see that there's almost 20 extinction factors. They focused just on 6. The 6 they looked at were population density, which is similar to our term, which is simply total population size. And I think they're accurate that a more significant factor is how many individuals exist per square kilometer. So population density in the environment. They looked at the longevity, how long an individual lives within that species. They looked at the maturation time, which is similar to our factor of generation time, the time between being born and being able to give birth. Although the thing that they were actually defining in terms of maturation time is how long the parents have to care for their young ones before their young ones are independent of the parents. And that, again, may be more important than simply the generation time. Then they looked at environmental threats, how many parasites it's got to deal with, how dangerous those parasites are, chemical exposure in the environment. They looked at predators, and then they looked at food diversity, how diverse their food supply is. Like cockroaches, for example, have a very diverse food supply, where there's many species of land mammals that only eat one thing. The panda, for example, only eats the leaves of the bamboo, and so it has a very limited food diversity. And then the last factor they looked at was habitat size, how large a habitat the species inhabits. And what they did for all 6 of these factors is they would take land mammals that all had a similar, say, habitat size, and then look at what body size would do in terms of extinction threat. And then they would look at food diversity. They would pick out land mammals that all had the same food diversity range, and see how extinction threat plots with respect to those creatures. And they did that for all 6 factors. And what they were able to show that in all 6 cases, the risk of rapid extinction goes up with the mass of the body mass. Average body mass, and then not in every single case they could see it going up. But what they also saw in all 6 cases is that there is a sharp increase in the rate at which it goes up, right at 3 kilograms, which is something quite unexpected. In other words, they saw all of them going up, but when it hits 3 kilograms, then it begins to go up very steeply. Which shows the bottom line end of the research paper's conclusion. Is that any land mammal that's got a body average body mass greater than 3 kilograms has orders of magnitude higher probability of going extinct before it can speciate into something distinctly different. And I'm saying something distinctly different for the following reason. In biology, our team counted 16 different definitions of what a species is. And so often you'll see in the scientific literature, we have proof of a brand new species. But that proof of a brand new species is based on an extremely narrow definition of what a species is. And other biologists would look at it and say, all you've produced is a new breed. Kind of like what we've done with dogs. I mean, if you breed dogs a special way, you can get dogs that are big and dogs that are small, but they're still dogs. Or what we've done with dairy cows. We can get cows that produce a lot of milk and cows that produce a little bit of milk, and when you look at the ones that produce a lot, I think they now have cows that produce 80 quarts a day. That's typical for a Holstein, that they'll come in at 80 to 90 quarts a day of milk. And, you know, that's a factor of 30 times more milk than what cows in the wild produce. And so you say, that's a brand new species. Look at a factor 30. That's huge. It's got to be a brand new species. But in fact, by other biologists' definition, you say that's simply breeding. It's not a new species. So that's just a caveat I give you. Sometimes when you read the scientific literature and they say, we've produced a brand new species, be careful. Probably the most famous example of that, and it's still broadly published, Jared Diamond is probably one of the more famous, certainly since the death of Stephen Gould, the more famous popularizers of the theory of Darwinian evolution. And he's on record in saying, we got these creationists beat. We produced a brand new species of daisies in just 9 years. And it happened in a place where I grew up, British Columbia, and I got to show Kathy these islands. So you go up the north end of Vancouver Island, there's all these islands packed into a strait, close together. Some really tiny, some really big, and this is where Jared Diamond did his research. And by the way, when he talked about daisies, they really were dandelions. Dandelions are a form of daisy. And you know how dandelions produce a parachute that carries a seed? Well, what Jared Diamond discovered is that in these islands off of British Columbia, if the island is small, the dandelions there produce small parachutes. Whereas in the big islands, they produce big parachutes. Well, it's kind of a duh kind of conclusion in that if you're on a small island and you produce big parachutes, guess where the seeds are going to go? They're going to go out in the ocean, and they're not going to reproduce. The only ones that are going to reproduce are the ones that have small parachutes and don't blow off the island. Whereas in the bigger islands, they can have bigger parachutes and they don't all blow away over the ocean. But, you know, I would really dispute Jared Diamond's claim that he has produced a brand new species of dandelion. All he's done is the equivalent of what we've done with dairy cows and dogs. But that's just a little warning when you read the literature. So that's why we made the point, distinctly different species, as opposed to a brand new species. But what this study shows is if you're bigger than 3 kilograms, there's no way you're going to speciate. You will be driven to extinction long before there's any decent possibility that you will produce a new species. In fact, I'll make a bold prediction here. This study on land mammals will produce the same result when it's done in reptiles. And I think that would be exciting. I'd love to see a study done in reptiles, because that would really close the door on the whole dinosaur evolution story that's going on. The neat thing about the dinosaurs is that all 3 generations, the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous, were wiped out by extraterrestrial collision events. So you've got a sudden extinction event, and within thousands of years, we have new dinosaurs on the face of the Earth with average body sizes a lot bigger than 3 kilograms. And this kind of study, repeated on reptiles, I think would conclusively demonstrate we cannot explain these creatures through natural process evolution. You need a supernatural creator to explain them. Yes. 3 kilograms, 7 pounds. Okay, so all of us here are in that category of having a body size. Well, almost all of us. Okay. She soon will be above 7 kilograms and therefore will not be in a position to. Yeah, and then, of course, the thing about human beings is we have this long maturation time. We have the longest maturation time of any creature on the planet. I look at my sons and I think, gee, we're looking at another 10. You mean they're 17 and 20 now? But they're not prepared to live on their own. So. Yeah, and that was the fun thing about these orcas, too. They have a long maturation time. But, you know, here off of northern British Columbia, you've got the largest pod of orcas in the world. Guess how large that is. It's a little less than 20 individuals. Okay? The orcas are really highly threatened by extinction. And especially what they're seeing in British Columbia is every year the numbers of orcas drop. Why? Because they're not getting the salmon they used to get. So, and when they don't get salmon, guess what they eat? They eat sea lions, seals, and the sea otters, other endangered creatures. So, anyway, just wanted to give you that little update. This has been very encouraging to us at Reason. By the way, we want to hear more about that. You can go to our Creation Update webcast. Fuzz and I had about a 25-minute discussion on this new piece of field research done. And by the way, when you read the paper, it doesn't conclude by saying, therefore, there must be a supernatural creator. But what it does conclude is that we have a problem here, and that we have this incredible kilograms body size. There is a balance between speciation and extinction. But field research shows a tremendous imbalance. So when you pick up this book, and by the way, that's the first thing that got me excited about reading this book when I was 17 years of age, is realizing it gave an answer to the enigma of the fossil record, that we see a balance between speciation and extinction all the way up until the appearance of human beings. After the appearance of human beings, we see an enormous imbalance. How does this book explain it? For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, he stops creating. And that's why we see a huge imbalance today. And the biggest imbalance we see is indeed for those species that have average body size, average body masses, greater than 7 pounds. So that was really my first clue that this book could be the Word of God. It's just seeing that in the first page. For 6 days he creates, on the seventh day he rests, and just seeing there's no evening or morning for the seventh day. We're still in the seventh day. That explains why the fossil record looks the way it does. Now, a lot of you are aware that intelligent design is big news today. And I appreciate your prayers because our part-time publicist has submitted my article on intelligent design to the New York Times, and they told us that they're seriously considering publishing it. So hopefully we'll see something positive happen here. But something that I thought was exciting, that I think is going to open the door for it, because what's happening in the political arena is this idea that we have to keep religion and science completely separate. And when I was here 2 weeks ago, before our little vacation, some of you asked me a question, what's going on at Harvard University? They made this big announcement that they were going to fund with millions of dollars from their own endowment, Origin of Life Research. And so I went on the web, and I went to the Harvard University website, got all the information from there. And indeed, what you heard is true. They're pouring millions of dollars of their own money into Origin of Life Research, millions per year. However, that's just the beginning. They're hoping by using their own money to fund Origins of Life Research that they'll be able to attract hundreds of millions of dollars from elsewhere. So actually what I found interesting, this is a fundraiser by Harvard University. They're investing a few millions of their own dollars with the hopes of raising at least $1 billion from outside. So I got to hand it to Harvard University. They got the biggest endowment of any university in the world, and they got really smart people raising money. And so this is a fundraising, partly a fundraising gambit on their part. But the guy who's really behind this is a professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Harvard. David Liu is his name. And he gave a beautiful quote here. I'm going to read you the quote. He said, my expectation is that we will be able to reduce this, namely the origin of life, to a very simple series of logical events that could have been taken place without any divine intervention. Okay, what I find exciting about that statement is that he's admitting from an atheist perspective that science and theology overlap and mix. Okay, because his mission is to show that the origin of life could happen without divine intervention. Well, now he's opened the door. Okay, this whole idea that we can keep intelligent design out, we can keep belief in God out of the scientific discipline, well, we got from Harvard University, from a leading atheist there, with millions of dollars behind him, saying, hey, we're on a mission to prove that God is not involved. Well, that legitimizes what we do at Reasons to Believe, to prove that God is involved. Yeah. Well, incidentally, what really motivated all this from this chemistry professor's perspective is the exciting discovery that there's water on Mars. is if that's going to be any help to the origin of life problem. So, and I find that rather interesting because the scientists at GPL that are discovering water on Mars are drawing the opposite conclusion, that there's so little water on Mars and it's so ephemeral that this is really a serious blow against the idea of a naturalistic origin of life on Mars. We've got to look somewhere else for the origin of life. Because, yeah, there's water on Mars, but it's just in tiny amounts. And it's entirely explained by cometary infall. Comets bring water to all the solar system bodies. The tricky part is keeping that water. And they're keeping a liquid state. And Mars doesn't do a good job of that. So, yeah. John, I appreciate you doing this, Bertrand, because when the class is oriented this way, my peripheral vision does not pick up all the hands. And John, since you're sitting on the extremity of the class, my apologies. No, in fact, I'm very pleased that Harvard is spending all this money, because I think, you know, the more money they spend, the more evidence they're going to uncover that it cannot happen through natural process. Although, if you think of our Origins of Life book, I think we already have the evidence to draw that conclusion. The other thing I found ironic in looking at David Liu's research, he claims that the first place they're going to spend all his money is trying to solve the homochorality problem. I mean, the rest of the Origins of Life community has long ago given up on that as being an impossible research line, but that's where he's going to start. And in one sense, I find that encouraging, because if I thought the origin of life took place through natural process, that's the first place I would look. The by the way, what does that mean? Sorry. Well, the building blocks of life are nucleotides and amino acids. The amino acids make the proteins, the nucleotides make the DNA and the RNA. And the amino acids, in order to assemble, to make a protein, must all have the same handedness. And amino acids come in two configurations, one with a hydrogen atom on the left-hand side, the other one with a hydrogen atom on the right-hand side. And so you want to have all of your amino acids oriented either left-handed or all of them oriented right-handed. And likewise, with the nucleotides, there are sugars associated with those nucleotides, and they all must be right-handed or all left-handed. Now, all of us in the room, in fact, all life on planet Earth, has left-handed amino acids and right-handed sugars. That's why the chemical industry is busy trying to make a cheap left-handed sugar, because then you could eat all the sugar you want, and it's not going to make you fat, okay? And it'll taste just like sugar, but it won't make you fat. But right now, it's expensive. So... Yeah, what we're thinking about doing, what we're thinking about doing is getting this guy on our show. That would be fun to get him on our show and just ask him some questions. You think you can solve the homochorality problem? We've got a few questions for you. So, but the problem is trying to find a natural way to get everything oriented left-handed or to get everything oriented right-handed. You can pick up our book. For 25 years, you've got people like William Bonner who have done everything under the sun to solve the problem and have proven that all natural processes will not orient it. The closest they've ever come is doing experiments with circularly polarized ultraviolet light. And what circularly polarized ultraviolet light does is preferentially destroy one amino acid relative to another. So basically, the ultraviolet light destroys the amino acids. However, it tends to destroy one-handedness more efficiently than the other-handedness. So you start with a big pile of amino acids, and what you wind up with is, say, 3% more right-handed amino acids as opposed to left-handed or the other way around. That's not going to help you. It's got to be 100%. Simply having 53% versus 47% is of no help at all. You've got to make it 0% versus 100%. And to get it all the way down to that, you've got to destroy everything. Or what we've explained in our book is, it only works if the circularly polarized ultraviolet light is all at just one wavelength. And that's because of what's called the Condon-Kuhn rule. Namely, that if you go one wavelength of circularly polarized ultraviolet light, that destroys right-handed amino acids, the immediately adjacent wavelength will destroy the other-handedness. So if you get two wavelengths, you get 50-50. And every natural source of circularly polarized light is non-monochromatic. It's at many wavelengths. Yes. By the way, this guy's an expert. He's a chemical engineer and a biologist at Caltech. So I appreciate what you got to say. Yeah. Oh, no, you can do this in the lab. I mean, you can do lab experiments. Now, that's already been done where they've used these ultraviolet lasers. In fact, it's been done up at the Livermore lab. They use circularly polarized light to their cyclotron, and they're able to, you know, actually get a significant excess of left-handed amino acids compared to right-handed, but they cannot get it to 100%. Even with 100% circularly polarized light at only one wavelength, about the best they get is about a 30% excess. So that's still not good enough. But the whole point is, that's not a good analogy for what happens in astrophysical sources. You know, everywhere else in the universe or on planet Earth, you have circularly polarized light at a variety of wavelengths, not just one wavelength. And when it's at a variety of wavelengths, the best you're going to get is about a 3% excess, which is going to be of no benefit to putting these things together. Anyway, it's all in the Origins of Life book, and the sooner this professor at Harvard figures out what everybody else has already figured out, then maybe the more that will... But what I really like is this statement saying, we're on a mission to prove that God's not involved. Which means that really justifies and legitimizes our effort to show that God is involved. You know, let's open up the debate. We think this is fantastic. You're in a mission to prove God's not involved. We're in a mission to prove that God is. Let's all get involved in the research, and let's see which way the evidence leads. Yeah. Now, Harvard plans is already committed to spend the money right now. So they've already committed several million for the next 12 months. And they said they would keep that up. And with that, they hope to attract hundreds of millions of additional dollars. So, yeah, this research is going to happen now. Well, you know, from our perspective, we think it already is conclusive. But the thing I've noticed, whenever theology gets well mixed into the science, the more conclusive you can make your conclusive result, the better. And that's why I keep reporting this class on new discoveries that make what we think is already an overwhelmingly secure conclusion even more secure. Why? Because in the heart of every man, woman, and child, there's this tendency to rebel against the authority of God, which means that in those areas that touch upon God taking authority over our lives, don't be surprised if you need a little more than just overwhelming evidence. Okay? I mean, think of your own conversion experience. I mean, I can think it took me 2 years to come to faith in Christ, and it took a lot more evidence than what I now would consider to be necessary, because there's that element of pride that needs to be overcome. And by the way, the thing I've noticed about hanging around very brilliant scientists, the higher their IQ, the greater the probability for pride to be a problem. I mean, you know, when I was at Caltech, the thing I noticed, maybe you're seeing this at Caltech too, is that you've got all these extremely bright people, IQs around 190, 200, 210, and they're all taking credit for their IQ. You know, I go on top of them and say, you know what? You had nothing to do with that. How can you take credit for being so bright? You had absolutely nothing to do with it. So, but anyway, let's get in. Yeah, fine, all right, okay. Yeah, go ahead. I'm going to try to get something in here in our study in the Book of Job. Yeah.